He wants to invite you home to live with him. She gave him a smirk. Penn sighed. I deserved that. She leaned close. Listen to me, Penderyn. She put her lips right up against his ear, her words a whisper. He may have given you away in a natchery. I don't know that he did, but he may have. He is a good man, but he panics when he's frightened. I've seen it before. He loses his perspective. He misplaces his common sense. If he betrayed us to Tarik Molt, he did so because he was afraid, she finished for him. If he is backed into a corner, he will not always do the sensible thing. That might have happened here. I wasn't with him on the waterfront, and I didn't see who he talked to. That druid might have found him and forced him to talk. You know they can. They can tell if you are lying. My father might have given you up to save his family and his ship. And for the money they are offering. She backed away a few inches so that he could see her face again. What matters now is that if he has done it once, he might try to do it again. Even out here. I don't want that to happen. I want you to stay safe. He closed his eyes. And I want you to come with me, he whispered, still feeling the softness of her mouth against his face. I want you to come now, not later. Tell me, Wilson Minson. I don't want to leave you behind. She lowered her head and let it rest on his shoulder. Do you love me, Penderyn? Yes, he said. He hadn't used the word before, even to himself, even in the silence of his mind. Love. He hadn't allowed himself to define what he was feeling, but as much as it was possible for him to do so, still young and inexperienced, he was willing to try. I do love you, he said. She burrowed her face in his neck. I wanted to hear you say it. I wanted you to speak the words. You have to come with me, he insisted again. I won't leave you behind. She shook her head. We're children, Pen. No, he said. Not anymore. He could sense her weighing her response. A dark certainty swept through him, and he closed his eyes against what he knew was coming. He was such a fool. He was asking her to leave her father, the man who had raised and cared for her, the strongest presence in her life. Why would she do that? Worse, he was asking her to accompany him to a place where no one in their right mind would go. She didn't know that, but he did. He knew how dangerous it was going to be. I'm sorry, Cinnaminson, he said quickly. I don't know what I was thinking. I don't have the right to ask you to come with me. I was being selfish. You have to stay with your father for now. What we decided before was right. That when it was time, I would come for you. But this isn't the time. This is too sudden. She lifted her head from his shoulder and faced him, her expression filled with wonder. In the dim light and with the mist damp and glistening against her skin, she looked so young. How old was she? He hadn't even thought to ask. You told me in an attire that you would come for me and take me with you whenever I was ready to go, she said. Is that still true? Do you love me enough to do that? Yes, he said. Then I want you to take me with you when we get to where we are going. I want you to take me now. He stared at her in disbelief. Now? But I thought, it's time, Pen. My father will understand. I will make him understand. I have served him long enough. I don't want to be his navigator anymore. I want a different life. I've been looking for that life for a long time. I think I have found it. I want to be with you. She reached out and touched his face, tracing its ridges and planes. You said you love me. I love you too. She hugged him then, long and hard. He closed his eyes, feeling her warmth seep through him. He loved her desperately, and he did not think for a moment that his age or his inexperience had blinded him to what that meant. He had no idea how he could protect her when he could barely manage to protect himself, but he would find a way. It will be all right, he whispered to her. But he knew that he spoke the words mostly to reassure himself. Chapter 24. At daybreak, Penn and his companions got a better look at the slags, and it wasn't encouraging. The wetlands had the look of a monstrous jungle, an impenetrable tangle of trees, vines, reeds, and swamp grasses, all rising out of a mix of algae-skinned waterways that stretched away as far as the eye could see. The eye couldn't see all that far, of course, since the mist of the previous night did not dissipate with the sun's rising, but continued to layer the slags in a heavy gray blanket. Swirling in and out of the undergrowth like a living thing, snaking its way through the twisted dark limbs of the trees and across the spiky carpet of grasses, it formed a wall that promised that any form of travel that didn't involve flying would be slow and dangerous. R.N. Elicidal took one good look at the morass surrounding the Skatelow, glanced up at a ceiling of clouds and mist hung so low that it scraped the airship's mast tip, and shook his head. No one would find them in this, he was thinking. But they might never find their way out again, either. "Here's how we go," Gar Hatch said, seeing the look on his face. It was warmer in the slags, and the rover was bare-chested and shiny with the mist's dampness. His muscles rippled as he climbed out of the pilot box and stood facing the elf. "It isn't as bad as it looks, first off. Bad enough, though, that it warrants caution if we stay on the water, and that's what we'll mostly do. We'll drop the mast, lighten our load as best we can, and work our way east through the channels, except we're flying as the only way through. It's slow, but it's sure. That big warship won't ever find us down here." Penn wasn't so sure, but Gar Hatch was captain, and no one was going to second-guess him. So they all pitched in to help take down the mainmast, laying it out along the decking, folding up the sails and spars and tucking them away, and tossing overboard the extra supplies they could afford to let go. It took most of the morning to accomplish this, and they worked as silently as they could manage. Sounds carry long distances in places like the slags. But they saw no sign of the Gallifile, and by midday they were sailing along the connecting waterways and across the flooded lowlands, easing through tight channels bracketed by gnarled trunks, and beneath bowers of limbs and vines, intertwined so thickly that they formed dark tunnels. 3 times they were forced to take to the air, lifting off gently, opening the parse tubes just enough to skate the treetops to the next open space, then landing and continuing on. It was slow going, as Hatch had promised, but they made steady time, and the journey progressed without incident. It might have been otherwise had the rover captain not been familiar with the waters. 2 times he brought the airship to a standstill in waters that ran deeper than most, and in the distance, Penn watched massive shapes slide just beneath the surface, stirring ripples that spread outward in great concentric circles. 1 times something huge surfaced just behind a screen of trees and brush, thrashing with such force that several of the trees toppled and the waters churned and rocked with the force of its movement. Yet nothing came close to the airship, for Hatch seemed to know when to stop and wait and when to go on. By nightfall they were deep in the wetlands, though much farther east than when they had started out, and there was still no sign of their pursuit. When asked of their progress, Hatch replied that they were a little more than halfway through. By the next night, if their luck continued to hold, they would reach the far side. That couldn't happen any too soon for Penn. He was already sick of the slags, of the smell and taste of the air, of the grayness of the light, unfriendly and wearing, of the sickness he felt lurking in the fetid waters, waiting to infect whoever was unfortunate enough to breathe it in. This was no place for people of any persuasion. Even on an airship, Penn felt vulnerable. But perhaps his anticipation of what was going to happen when it was time to leave the Skatelow was working on him as well. Taking Cinnaminson from her father was not going to be pleasant. He did not for a moment doubt that he could do it, did not once question that he could do whatever was necessary. But thinking about it made him uneasy. Gar Hatch was a dangerous man, and Penn did not underestimate him. He thought that Cinnaminson's fears about what might have happened in Anachere were well-founded. Gar Hatch probably did betray them to Terek Molt. He probably thought they would never live to reach the Skatelow to finish this voyage, and that was why he was so distressed when R.N. Elicidal reappeared and ordered him to set sail. It wasn't unfinished repairs or stocking of supplies that had upset him. It was the fact that he had been forced to go at all. What would he do when he found out that his daughter, his most valuable asset in his business, was leaving him to go with Penn? He would do something. The boy was certain of it. On the other hand, Penn hadn't done much to help matters along from his end either. He hadn't said a word to his three companions about what he and Cinnaminson had agreed upon. He didn't know how. Certainly Tagwin and Kyber would never support him. The dwarf would do nothing that would jeopardize their efforts to reach the Ardris, and the elven girl already thought his involvement with Cinnaminson was a big mistake. Only Arran Elysidal was likely to demonstrate any compassion, any willingness to grant his request. But he didn't know how best to approach the druid, so he had delayed all day, thinking each time he considered speaking that he would do so later. Well, later was here. It was nightfall, dinner behind them by now, and the next day was all the time he had left. He couldn't wait much longer. He couldn't chance being turned down with no further opportunity to press his demand. But before he could act on his thinking, Gar Hatch wandered over in the twilight and said, "I'd like to speak with you a moment, young Pendaren. Alone." He took the boy up into the pilot box, separating him from the others. Penn forced himself to stay calm, to not glance over at Arran and Kyber, to resist the urge to check how close they were if he needed rescuing. He knew what was coming. He had not thought Cinnaminson would be so quick to tell her father, but then there was no reason why she should wait. He wished fleetingly, however, that she had told him she had done so. Standing before Penn, the misty light so bad by now that the boy could barely make out his features, Gar Hatch shook his bearded head slowly. "My girl tells me she's leaving the ship," he said softly. "Leaving with you. Is this so?" Penn had given no thought at all to what he would say when this moment happened, and now he was speechless. He forced himself to look into the other's hard eyes. "It is." "She says you will love her." "True?" "Yes, I do." The big man regarded him silently for a moment, as if deciding whether to toss him overboard. "You're sure about this, are you, Pendaren? You're awfully young, and you don't know my girl very well yet. It might be better to wait on this." Penn took a deep breath. "I think we know each other well enough. I know we are young, but we aren't children. We're ready." Another long moment of silence followed. The big man studied him carefully, and Penn felt the weight of his gaze. He wanted to say something more, but he couldn't think of anything that would make it any easier. So he kept still. "Well," the other said finally, "it seems you've made up your minds, the two of you. I don't think I can stop you without causing hard feelings, and I'm not one for doing that." "I think it's a mistake, Pendaren, but if you have decided to try it, then I won't stand in your way. You seem a good lad. I know Cinnaminson has grown weary of life on the Skaitlow. She wants more for herself, a different way of life. She's entitled. Do you think you can take care of her as well as I have?" Penn nodded. "I will do my best. I think we will take care of each other." Hatch grunted. "Easier said than done, lad. If you fail her, I'll come looking for you. You know that, don't you?" "I won't fail her. I don't care who your family is or what sort of magic they can call on to use against poor men like myself," he continued, ignoring Penn. "I'll come looking for you, and you can be sure I will find you." Penn didn't care for the threat, but he supposed it was the rover captain's way of venting his disappointment at what was happening. Besides, he didn't think there would ever be cause for the big man to act on it. "I understand," he replied. "Best that you do. I won't say I'm the least bit happy about this. I'm not. I won't say I think it will work out for you. I don't. But I will give you your chance with her, Pendaren, and hold you to your word. I just hope I won't ever have cause to regret doing so." "You won't." "Go on, then." The big man gestured toward Arran and Kyber, who stood talking at the port railing. "Go back to your friends. We have a full day of sailing tomorrow, and you want to be arrested for it." Penn left the pilot box in a state of some confusion. He had not expected Gar Hatch to be so accommodating, and it bothered him. He hadn't lodged more than a mild protest, hadn't tried to talk Penn out of it, hadn't even gone to Arran Elysidal to voice his disapproval. Perhaps Cinnaminson had persuaded him not to do any of those things, but that didn't seem likely to Penn. Maybe, he thought suddenly, Hatch was waiting for the druid to put an end to their plans. Maybe he knew how unreceptive Penn's companions would be and was waiting for them to put a stop to things. But that didn't feel right either. Garhatch wasn't the sort to count on someone else to solve his problems. That kind of behavior wasn't a part of the rover ethic, and certainly not in keeping with the big man's personality. Penn looked around for Cinnaminson but didn't see her. She would be up on deck later, perhaps, but since they were not flying that night, she might be asleep. Penn glanced at Aran and Kyber. He should tell the druid now what was happening, give him some time to think about it before he responded. But just as he started over, Tagwin appeared from below decks to join them, grumbling about sleeping in tight, airless spaces that rocked and swayed. The boy took a moment longer to consider what he should do and decided to wait. First thing in the morning, he would speak with Aran Elisidal. That would be soon enough. He would be persuasive, he told himself. The druid would agree. Feeling a little tired and oddly out of sorts, he took Garhatch's advice and went down to his cabin to sleep. He awoke to shouting, to what was obviously an alarm. Bounding up instantly, still half asleep, he tried to orient himself. Across the way, Tagwin was looking similarly disoriented, staring blankly into space from his hammock, eyes bleary and unfocused. The shouting died into harsh whispers that were audible nevertheless, even from below decks. Boots thudded across the planking from one railing to the other, then stopped. Silence descended, deep and unexpected. Penn could not decide what was happening and worried that by the time he did, it would be too late to matter. With a hushed plea to Tagwin to follow as quickly as he could, he pulled on his boots and went out the cabin door. The corridor was empty as he hurried down its short length to the ladder leading up and climbed swiftly toward the light, straining to hear something more. When he pushed open the hatch, he found the dawn had arrived with a deep, heavy fog that crawled through the trees and over the decks of the Skatelow. At first he didn't see anyone, then found Garhatch, the two rover crewmen, Aran Elisidal and Kyber standing on the bow, peering everywhere at once, and he hurried over to join them. One of the crewmen caught a glimpse of the Gallifile just moments ago, right overhead, flying north, the druid whispered. He called out a warning, which might have given us away. We're waiting to see if she comes back around. They stood in a knot, scanning the misty gray, watching for movement. Long minutes passed, and nothing appeared. There's a channel just ahead that tunnels through these trees, Garhatch said quietly. It goes on for several miles through heavy foliage. Once we get in there, we can't be seen from the sky. It's our best chance to lose them. They pulled up the fore and aft anchors and set out. Breakfast was forgotten. All that mattered was getting the ship under cover. Everyone but Cinnaminson was on deck now. Penn thought to go look for her, but decided it would be wrong to leave in the midst of the crisis. He might be needed. Hatch might require help piloting the craft. He stayed close, watching as the rover captain took the Skatelow through a series of connecting lakes spiked with grasses and studded with dead tree trunks, easing her carefully along, all the while with one eye on the broom-thickened sky. The rover crewman moved forward, taking readings with weighted lines, hands signaling warnings when shallows or submerged logs appeared in front of them. No one said a word. The channel appeared without warning. A black hole through an interwoven network of limbs and gnarled trunks. It had the look of a giant's hungry maw as they sailed into it, and the temperature dropped immediately once they were inside. Penn shivered. Overhead, he caught small glimpses of sky, but mostly the dark canopy of limbs was all that was visible. The channel was wide enough to allow passage, though the Skatelow wouldn't have been able to get through if her mast had been up. As it was, the rover crewman had to use poles to push her away from the tangle of tree roots that grew on either side and keep her centered in the deeper water. It was too dark for Penn to see exactly what they were doing, but he was certain they could not have done it without Hatch. He seemed to know what was needed at every turn and kept them moving ahead smoothly. Still, Cinnaminson didn't appear. Penn glanced over his shoulder repeatedly, but there was no sign of her. He began to worry anew. Ahead, the tunnel opened back into the light. Garhatch called him into the pilot box. Take the helm, young Penderin. I need to be at the bow for this. Penn did as he was told. Hatch went forward to stand with his men, the three of them using poles to ease the skate-low along the channel, pointing her toward the opening. Now and again he would signal the boy to swing the rudder to starboard or port. They were almost through, and there was a scraping sound and a violent lurch. Penn was thrown backwards into the railing, and for an instant he thought that whatever had happened, he had done something wrong. But as he stood up and hurried forward, he realized he hadn't done anything he hadn't been told to do. Gar Hatch was peering over the side of the airship into the murky waters, shaking his head. "That one's new," he muttered to no one in particular, then pointed out the massive log that the airship had run up on. He glanced up at the canopy of trees. "Too tight a fit to try to fly her. We'll have to float her off and pull her through by hand." Hatch went back up into the pilot box, advising Penn that he would take the controls. There was no admonition in his voice, so Penn didn't argue. Together with Tagwin, R.N. Elicidal, and the two crewmen, Penn climbed down onto the tangled knot of tree roots and moved forward of the airship's bow. Using ropes lashed about iron cleats, they began to pull the skate low ahead, easing her over the fallen trunk. Eventually, the airship gained just enough lift from Garhatch's skilled handling to break free of the log and begin crawling along the swamp's green surface once more. It was backbreaking work. Bugs of all sorts swarmed about their faces, clouding their vision, and the root tangle on which they were forced to stand was slick with moss and damp with mist, and offered uncertain footing. All of them went down at one point or another, skidding and sliding into the swamp water, fighting to keep from going under. But slowly, they maneuvered the skate low down the last few yards of the channel, easing her toward the open sky where the light brightened and the broom thinned. "Move back!" Gar Hatch shouted abruptly. "Release the ropes!" Penn, Tagwin, and R.N. Elicidal did as they were ordered and watched the airship sail by, the hull momentarily blocking from view the rover crewmen who were working across the way. When Penn glanced over again in the wake of the ship's passing, the crewmen were gone. It took the boy a second to realize what was happening. "R.N.," he shouted in warning. "We've been tricked!" He was too late. The skate low began to pick up speed, moving into the center of the bay. Then Kyber Elicidal came flying over the side and landed in the murky waters with a huge splash. The faces of the crewmen appeared and they waved tauntingly at the men on shore. Tagwin was shouting at R.N. Elicidal to do something, but the druid only stood there, shaking his head, grim-faced and angry. There was nothing he could do, Penn realized, without using magic that would alert the Gallifile. Slowly the skate low began to lift away, to rise into the mist, to disappear. In seconds, she was gone. At the center of the lake, Kyber Elicidal pounded at the water in frustration. Chapter 25. No one said anything for a few moments. Penn, Tagwin, and R.N. Elicidal standing together at the edge of the bay like statues, staring with a mix of disbelief and frustration at the point where the skate low had disappeared into the mist. "I knew we couldn't trust that man," Tagwin muttered finally. At the center of the bay, Kyber Elicidal had given up pounding the water and was swimming toward them. Her strokes cleaved the greenish waters smoothly and easily. "You can't trust rovers," Tagwin went on bitterly. "Not any of them. Don't know why we thought we could trust Hatch." "We didn't trust him," R.N. Elicidal pointed out. "We just didn't watch him closely enough. We let him outsmart us." "This is my fault," Penn thought. "I caused this. Gar Hatch didn't abandon them because of anything the others had done, or even because of the Gallifile and the druids. He had abandoned them so that Penn couldn't take Cinnaminson away from him. That was why he had been so accommodating. That was why he didn't argue the matter more strongly. He didn't care what either Penn or his daughter intended. He was going to put a stop to it in any case. Kyber reached the edge of the bay and stood up with some difficulty, water cascading off her drenched clothes. Anger radiated from her like heat from a forge as she stalked ashore to join them. "Why did he do that?" she snapped furiously. "What was the point of abandoning us now when we were so close to leaving him anyway?" "It's because of me," Penn said at once, and they all turned to look at him. "I'm responsible." He revealed to them what he and Cinnaminson had decided, how she had told her father, and what her father had obviously decided to do about it. He apologized over and over for not confiding in them and admitted that by deciding to take the girl off the airship, he was thinking of himself and not of them or even of what they had come to do. He was embarrassed and disappointed, and it was all he could do to get through it without breaking down. Kyber glared at him when he was finished. "You are an idiot, Penderyn Ohmsford." Penn bit back his angry reply, thinking that he had better just take whatever they had to say to him and be done with it. "That doesn't help us, Kyber," her uncle said softly. "Penn loves this girl, and he was trying to help her. I don't think we can fault him for his good intentions. He might have handled it better, but at the time he did the best he could. It's easy to second-guess him now. You might want to ask yourself what Hatch will do to her now that he knows what she intended and no outsiders are about to interfere," Tagwin said to Penn. Penn had already thought of that, and he didn't like the conclusion he had reached. Gar Hatch would not be happy with his daughter and would not trust her again any time soon. He would make a virtual prisoner of her, and once again, it was his fault. Kyber stalked away. She stopped a short distance off and stood looking out at the bay with her hands on her hips, then wheeled back suddenly. "Sorry I snapped at you, Penn. Gar Hatch is a sneak and a coward to do this. But the matter isn't finished. We'll see him again, somewhere down the road. He will be the one who goes over the side of that airship the next time, I promise you." "Meanwhile, what are we supposed to do?" Tagwin asked, looking from one face to the next. "How do we get out of here?" Arena Lissadil glanced around thoughtfully, then shrugged. "We walk." "Walk?" Tagwin was aghast. "We can't walk out of here. You have seen this morass, this pit of vipers and swamp rats. If something doesn't eat us, we'll be sucked down in the quicksand. Besides, it will take us days, and that's only if we don't get lost, which we will." The druid nodded. "The alternative is to use magic. I could summon a rock to carry us out, but if I do that, I will give us away to Terek Molt. He will reach us long before any help does." Tagwin scrunched up his face and folded his arms across his chest. "I'm just saying I don't think we can walk out of here, no matter how determined we are." "There might be another way," Penn interjected quickly. "One that's a little quicker and safer." Arena Lissadil turned to him, surprise mirrored in his blue eyes. "All right, Penn. Let's hear what it is." "I hope it's a better idea than his last one," Tagwin grumbled before Penn could speak, and set his jaw firmly as he prepared to pass judgment. He showed them how to build the raft, using heavier logs for the hull, slender limbs for the cradle, and reeds for binding. It needed to be only big enough to support the four of them, so a platform measuring 10 feet by 10 feet was adequate. The materials were easy enough to find, even in the slags, though not so easy to shape, mostly because they lacked the requisite tools and had to make do with long knives. On more than one occasion, Penn had built similar rafts before and knew something about how to construct them, so that they wouldn't fall apart mid-journey. Working in pairs, they gathered the logs and limbs for the platform and carried them to a flat piece of earth on which they could lay them out and lash them together. They worked through the morning, and by midday they were finished. The raft was crude, but it was strong enough to support them and light enough to allow for portage. Most important, it floated. They had no supplies, nothing but the clothes they wore and the weapons they carried, so after crafting poles to push their vessel through the swamp, they set out. It was slow going, even with the raft to carry them, the swamp a morass of weed-choked bays and log-jammed channels that they were forced to backtrack through and portage around repeatedly. Even so, they made much better progress than they would have afoot. For just the second time since they had set out, Penn was able to make practical use of his magic, to intuit from the sounds and movements of the plants, birds, and animals around them the dangers that lay waiting. Calling out directions to the other three as they worked the poles, he concentrated on keeping them clear of submerged debris that might have damaged their craft and well away from the more dangerous creatures that lived in the slags, some of them huge and aggressive. By staying close to the shoreline and out of the deeper water, they were able to avoid any confrontations, and Penn was able to tell himself that he was making at least partial amends for his part in contributing to the fix they were in. By nightfall, they were exhausted and still deep in the slags. Penn's pocket compass had kept them on the right heading, of that much he was certain, but how much actual progress they had made was debatable. Since none of them knew exactly where they were, it was impossible to judge how far they still had to go. Nothing about the wetland had changed. The mist was thick and unbroken. The waterways extended off in all directions, and the undergrowth was identical to what they had left behind 6 hours earlier. There was nothing to eat or drink, so after agreeing to split the watch into 4 shifts, they went to sleep, hungry and thirsty and frustrated. During the night, it rained. Penn, who was on watch at the time, used his cloak to catch enough drinking water that they were able to satisfy at least one need. After the rain stopped and the water was consumed, Kyber and Tagwin went back to sleep, but Aran Elicidal chose to sit up with the boy. "Are you worried about Cinnaminson?" Aran asked when they were settled down together at the edge of the raft, their backs to the sleepers, their cloaks wrapped about them. It was surprisingly cold at night in the slags. The boy stared out into the dark without answering. Then he sighed. "I can't do anything to help her. I can help us, but not her. She's smart and she's capable, but her father is too much for her. He sees her as a valuable possession, something he almost lost. I don't know what he will do." The druid folded himself deeper into his robes. "I don't think he will do anything. I think he believes he made an example of us, so she won't cross him again. He doesn't think we will get out of here alive, Penn. Or if we do, that we will escape the Gallifile." Penn pulled his knees up to his chest and lowered his chin between them. "Maybe he's right."
"Oh?"
"It's just that we're not getting anywhere." The boy tightened his hands into fists and lowered his voice to a whisper. "We aren't any closer to helping Aunt Grianne than we were when we started out. How long can she stay alive inside the Forbidding? How much time does she have?"
Aran Elicidal shook his head. "A lot more than anyone else I can think of. She's a survivor, Penn. She can endure more hardships than most. It doesn't matter where she is or what she is up against, she will find a way to stay alive. Don't lose heart. Remember who she is."
The boy shook his head. "What if she has to go back to being who she was? What if that's the only way she can survive? I listened to my parents talk about what she was like when they thought I wasn't listening. She shouldn't have to be made to do those kinds of things again."
The druid gave him a thin smile.
"I don't think that's what has you worried."
The boy frowned.
"What do you mean?"
"I don't think you were worried about whether we will reach the Ardres in time to be of help. I think you are worried about whether you will be able to do what is needed when the time comes. I think you are worried about failing."
Penn was instantly furious, but he kept his tongue in check as he looked out again into the mist and gloom, thinking it through, weighing the druid's words. Slowly, he felt his anger soften. "You're right," he admitted finally. "I don't think I can save her. I don't see how I can manage it. I'm not strong or talented enough. I don't have magic like my father. I'm nothing special. I'm just ordinary." He looked at the druid. "What am I going to do if that isn't enough?"
Aran Elicidal pursed his lips. "I was your age when I sailed on the Gerald Shannara. Just a boy. My brother sent me because he was secretly hoping I wouldn't come back. Ostensibly, I was sent to regain possession of the Elfstones, but mostly I was sent with the expectation that I would be killed. But I wasn't, and when I found the Elfstones, I was able to use them. I didn't think such a thing was possible. I ran from my first battle so frightened I barely knew what I was doing. I hid until someone found me, someone who was able to tell me what I am telling you, that you will do your best. And your best might surprise you."
"But you just said you had the Elfstones to rely on."
"I don't."
"But you do have magic. Don't underrate it.
You don't know how important it might turn out to be. But that isn't what will make the difference when it matters. It is the strength of your heart. It is your determination."
He leaned forward. "Remember this, Penderyn. You are the one who was chosen to save the Ardres. That was not a mistake.
The king of the Silver River sees the future better than anyone, better even than the shades of the druids. He would not have come to you if you were not the right person to undertake this quest. Penn searched Aren's eyes uncertainly. I wish I could believe that.
I wished the same thing 20 years ago. But you have to take it on faith. You have to believe that it will happen. You have to make it come true. No one can do it for you.
Penn nodded. Words of wisdom, well meant, but he didn't find them helpful. All he could think about was how ill-equipped he was to rescue anyone from a place like the Forbidding.
I still think it would have been better to send you, he said quietly. I still don't understand why the King of the Silver River decided on me.
Because he knows more about you than you know yourself, the druid answered. He rose and stretched. The watch is mine now. Go to sleep. You need to rest, to be ready to help us again tomorrow. We aren't out of danger yet. We are depending on you.
Penn moved away without comment, sliding to one side, joining Kyber and Tagwin at the other end of the raft, where both were sleeping fitfully. He lay down and pulled his cloak closer, resting his head in the crook of his arm. He didn't sleep right away, but stared out into the misty gloom, the swirling of the haze hypnotic and suggestive of other things. His thoughts drifted to the events that had brought him to that place and time, and then to Aren Elicidal's encouraging words. That he should believe so strongly in Penn was surprising, especially after how badly the boy had handled the matter of Cinnaminson and Gar Hatch. But Penn could tell when someone was lying to him, and he did not sense falsehood in the other's words. The druid saw him as the rescuer he had been charged with being. Penn would find a way, he believed, even if the boy did not yet know what that way was. Penn breathed deeply, feeling a calmness settle through him. Weariness played a part in that, but there was peace as well. If my father was here, he would have spoken those same words to me, he thought. There was comfort in knowing that. He closed his eyes and slept. They woke to a dawn shrouded in mist and gloom, their bodies aching with the cold and damp. Once again, there was nothing to eat or drink, so they put their hunger and thirst aside and set out. As they poled through the murky waters, stands of swamp grass clutched at them with anxious tendrils. Everywhere, shadows stretched across the water and through the trees, snakes they didn't want to wake. No one spoke. Chilled by the swamp's gray emptiness, they retreated inside themselves. Their determination kept them going. Somewhere up ahead was an end to the morass, and there was only one way to reach it. At midday, they were confronted by a huge stretch of open water, surrounded by vine-draped trees and clogged by heavy swamp grass. Islands dotted the lake, grassy hummocks littered with rotting logs. Overhead, mist swirled like thick soup in a kettle, sunlight weakened by its oily mix, a hazy wash that spilled gossamer pale through the heavy branches of the trees. They stopped poling and stared out across the marshy, ragged expanse. The islands jutted from the water like reptile eyes. Penn looked at Aren Elicidal and shook his head. He didn't like the feel of the lake and did not care to try to cross it. Ripples at its center hinted at the presence of things best avoided. Follow the lake shore, the druid said, glancing at the sky. Stay under the cover of the trees. Watch the surface of the water for movement. They chose to veer left, where the shallows were not as densely clogged with grasses and deadwood. Poling along some 20 feet offshore, Penn kept one eye on the broad expanse of the lake, scanning for ripples. He knew the others were depending on his instincts to keep them safe. Out on the open water, trailers of mist skimmed the viscous surface. A sudden squall came and went like a ghost. The air felt heavy and thick, and condensation dripped from the trees in a slow, steady rhythm. Within the shadowy interior of the woods surrounding the lake, the silence was deep and oppressive. At the lake's center, something huge lifted in a shadowy parting of waters and was gone again, silent as smoke. Penn glanced at Kyber, who was poling next to him on the raft. He saw the fierce concentration in her eyes waver. They had gone some distance when the shoreline receded into a deep bay overhung with vines that dipped all the way to the water's dark surface.
Cautiously, they maneuvered under the canopy, sliding through the still waters with barely a whisper of movement, eyes searching. The hairs on the back of Penn's neck prickled in warning. Something felt wrong. Then he realized what it was. He wasn't hearing anything from the life around him. Not a sound, not a single movement, nothing. A vine brushed against his face, sliding away almost reluctantly, leaving a glistening trail of slime on his skin. He wiped the sticky stuff from his face, grimacing, and glanced upward. A huge mass of similar vines was writhing and twisting directly overhead. Not quite sure what he was looking at, he stared in disbelief, then in fear. "Aren," he whispered. Too late. The vines dropped down like snakes to encircle them, a cascade of long arms and supple fingers, tentacles of all sizes and shapes, attacking with such ferocity and purpose that they had no time even to think of reaching for their weapons. His arms pinned to his sides, Penn was swept off the raft and into the air. Tagwin flew past him, similarly wrapped about. The boy looked up and saw so many of the vines entwined in the forest canopy that it felt as if he were being drawn into a basket of snakes. Then he saw something else, something much worse. Within the masses of tentacles were mouths, huge beaked maws that clacked and snapped and pulsed with life. Like squids, he thought, waiting to feed. It had taken only seconds for the vines to immobilize him, only seconds more for them to lift him toward the waiting mouths, all of it so quick he barely had time to comprehend what was happening. Now he fought like a wild man, kicking and screaming, determined to break free. But the vines held him securely, and slowly, inexorably, they drew him in. Then spears of fire thrust into the beaks and tentacles from below, their flames a brilliant azure, burning through the shadows and gloom. The vines shuddered violently, shaking Penn with such force that he lost all sense of which way was up. An instant later they released him altogether, dropping him, stunned and disoriented, into the swamp. He struck with an impact that jarred his bones and knocked the breath from his body, and he was underwater almost instantly, fighting to right himself, to reach air again. He broke the surface with a gasp, thrashing against a clutch of weeds, seeing scythes of blue fire slash through the canopy in broad sweeps, smelling wood and plants burn, hearing the hiss and crackle of their destruction, tasting smoke and ash on the air. Overhead, the canopy was alive with twisting vines, some of them aflame, others batting wildly at burning neighbors. He saw Aran Elicidal standing on the raft, both hands thrust skyward, his elemental magic the source of the fire, summoned from the ether and released from his fingers in jagged darts. "Penn!" someone yelled. Kyber had surfaced next to the raft and was hanging on one end, trying to balance the uneven platform so that her uncle could defend them. The swamp waters had turned choppy and rough, and it was all the druid could do to keep from being tossed overboard. Penn swam to their aid, seizing the end of the raft opposite the elven girl, the vines whipping all about him. An instant later, Tagwin dropped out of the canopy, his bearded face a mask of confusion and terror as he plunged into the murky waters and then surfaced next to Penn. "Push us out into the bay," Aran Elicidal shouted, dropping to one knee as his tiny platform tilted precariously. Kicking strongly, Penn and Kyber propelled the raft toward open water, fighting to get clear of the deadly trap. Tagwin hung on tenaciously, and Aran continued to send shards of fire into the clutching vines, which were still trying to get at him, but were unable to break past his defenses. Smoke billowed and roiled in heavy clouds, mingling with swamp mist to form an impenetrable curtain. From somewhere distant, the frightened cries of water birds rose. When at last they were far enough from the vines to pause in their efforts, Penn and Kyber crawled onto the raft beside Aran Elicidal, pulled Tagwin up after them, and collapsed, gasping for breath. For several long seconds no one said anything, their eyes fixed on the smoky mass of tree vines now some distance off. "We were lucky," Penn said finally. "Don't be stupid," Kyber snapped in reply. "Look what we've done. We've given ourselves away." Penn stared at her, recognition setting in. She was right. He had forgotten what Aran Elicidal had said about how using magic would reveal their presence to those who hunted them. Aran had saved them, but he had betrayed them as well. Taric Molt would know exactly where they were. The Gallif Isle would track them to the bay. "What can we do?" he asked in dismay. Kyber turned to her uncle. How much time do we have, Uncle Arryn? The druid shook his head. Not much. They will come for us quickly. He climbed to his knees and looked around. Everything was clouded with smoke. If they are close, we won't even have time to get off this bay. We can hide, Penn suggested hurriedly, glancing skyward for movement for any sign of their pursuers. Perhaps on one of the islands. We can sink the raft. Arryn shook his head. No, Pandaren. We need to go ashore and find a place to make a stand. We need space in which to move and solid ground on which to do it. He handed the boy one of the two remaining poles. Try to get us ashore, Penn. Choose a direction. Do the best you can, but do it quickly. With Arryn working on the opposite side, Penn began poling toward shore once more, farther down from where the vines still thrashed and burned, farther along in the direction they had been heading. They made good time, borne on the crest of a tide stirred by their battle with the vines, a tide that swept them east. But Penn sensed that however swiftly they moved, it wasn't going to be swift enough. This is all my fault, he kept thinking. Again. The haze continued thick and unbroken, layering the surface of the water in a roiling blanket that stank of burning wood and leaves. Slowly the bay went quiet again, the waters turning slate black and oily once more, a dark reflection of the shadows creeping in from the shoreline. Penn poled furiously, thinking that if they could just reach a safe place to land, they might lose themselves in the trees. It would not be easy to find them in this jungle, this swamp, this morass, not even for Terek Malt. All they needed to do was gain the shore. They did so, finally. They beached on a mud bank fronting a thick stand of cypress, tangled all about with vines and banked with heavy grasses. They pulled their raft ashore, hauled it back into the trees, and set out walking. The silence of the slags closed about them, deep and pervasive, an intrusive and brooding companion. Penn could hear the sound of his breathing. He could feel the pumping of his heart. Still, there was no sign of their pursuers. We're going to escape them after all, he thought in sudden relief. They walked for several hours, well past midday and deep into the afternoon. The shoreline snaked in and out of the trees, and they stayed at its edge, keeping a sharp eye out for more of the deadly vines and any sign of movement on the bay waters. They did not talk, their efforts concentrated on putting one foot in front of the other, Arryn Illicital setting a pace that even Penn, who was accustomed to long treks, found difficult to match. It was late in the afternoon, the shadows of twilight beginning to lengthen out of the west, when they found the eastern end of the lake. It swung south in a broad curve, the ground lifting to a wall of old growth through which dozens of waterways opened. Penn searched the gloom ahead without finding anything reassuring, then took a moment to read his compass, affirming what Arryn, with his druidic senses, had already determined. They were on course, but not yet clear of the swamp. Then sudden brightness flared behind them, dispersing the mist and brightening the gloom as if dawn had broken. They wheeled back as one, shielding their eyes. It looked as if the swamp were boiling from a volcanic eruption, its waters churning, steaming with an intense heat. The dark prow of an airship nosed through the fading haze like a great lumbering bear, slowly settling toward the waters of the bay, black nose sniffing the air. Penn fought to keep from shaking with the chill that swept through him. The Gallifile had found them. Chapter 26. The huge curved horns of the Gallifile's bow swung slowly about to point like a compass needle toward the four who stood frozen on the muddy shoreline. There was no mistaking that she had found what she was searching for. Through the fading screen of mist and twilight's deepening shadows, the vessel settled onto the reed-choked surface of the bay, not 50 yards away, and slowly began to advance. Her sails were furled and her masts and spars as bare and black as charred bones. She had the stark, blasted look of a specter. "What do we do?" Kyber hissed. "We can run," Penn answered at once, already poised to do so. "There's still time to gain the trees, get deep into the woods, split up if we have to." He trailed off hopelessly. It was pointless to talk about running away. Arryn had already said that it was too late to hide, so running would not help either. The Gallifile had already found them once. Even if they ran, it would have no trouble doing so again. Terek Molt would track them down like rabbits.
They were going to have to make a stand, even without an airship in which to maneuver or weapons with which to fight. Aran Elicidal's druid magic and whatever resources the rest of them could muster were going to have to be enough. What other choice do we have? Penn thought in despair. The Gallifile had come to a stop at the edge of the shoreline, advanced as close to the mud bank as her draft would allow. Atop her decks, dark figures moved, taking up positions along the railing. Gnome hunters. Penn saw the glittering surfaces of their blades. Perhaps the gnome hunters simply meant to kill them, having no need to do otherwise. "Do you see how she shimmers?" Aran Elicidal asked them suddenly. His voice was eerily calm. "The ship, about her hull and rigging. Do you see?" Penn looked with the others. At first he couldn't make it out, but then slowly his eyes adjusted to the heavy twilight, and he saw a sort of glow that pulsed all about the warship, an aura of glistening dampness. "What is it?" Kyber whispered, brushing back her mop of dark hair, twisting loose strands of it in her fingers. "Magic," her uncle answered softly. "Tarek Molt is sheathing the Gallifile in magic to protect her from an attack. He is wary of what we did to him last time, of another storm, of the elements I can summon to disrupt his efforts." The druid exhaled slowly. "He has made a mistake. He has given us a chance." A rope ladder was lowered over the side of the airship, one end dropping through a railing gap and into the water. A solitary figure began to descend. Even from a distance and through the heavy gloom, there was no doubt about who it was. Penn glanced up again at the cloaked figures lining the Gallifile's railing. All their weapons were pointed at himself and his companions. "Kyber," Aran Elicidal called softly. When she looked over, he passed her something, a quick exchange that was barely noticeable. Penn caught a glimpse of the small pouch as her hand opened just far enough to permit her to see that it was the elf stones she had been given. Her quick intake of breath was audible. "Listen carefully," her uncle said without looking at her, his eyes fixed on Tarek Molt, who was almost to the water now. "When I tell you, use the elf stones against the Gallifile. Do as you have been taught. Open your mind, summon their power, and direct it at the airship." Kyber was already shaking her head, her elven features taut with dismay. "It won't work, Uncle Aran. The magic is only good against other magic. Magic that threatens the holder of the stones. You taught me that yourself. The Gallifile is an airship, wood and iron only." "She is," the druid agreed. "But thanks to Tarek Molt, the magic that sheathes her is not. It is his magic, druid magic. Trust me, Kyber, it is our only chance. I am skilled, but Tarek Molt was trained as a warrior druid and is more powerful than I am. Do as I say. Watch for my signal. Do not reveal that you have the elf stones before then. Do nothing to demonstrate that you are a danger to him. If you do, if you give yourself away too early, even to help me, we are finished." Penn glanced at Kyber. The elven girl's eyes glittered with fear. "I've never even tried to use the elf stones," she said. "I don't know what it takes to summon the magic. What if I can't do so now?" Aran Elicidal smiled. "You can, and you will, Kyber. You have the training and the resolve. Do not doubt yourself. Be brave. Trust the magic and your instincts. That will be enough." Tarek Molt stepped down off the ladder and into the shallow water, turning to face them. His black robes billowed out behind him as he approached, his blocky form squared toward Aran Elicidal. He radiated confidence and disdain, the set of his dark form signaling his intent in a way that was unmistakable. "Move to one side, Kyber," Aran said quietly, his voice ticking on an edge. "Remember what I said. Watch for my signal. Penn, Tagwin, back out of the way." The boy and the dwarf retreated at once, happy to put as much distance as possible between themselves and Tarek Molt. The warrior druid's chiseled face glanced in their direction, a slight lifting of his chin the only indication that he noticed them at all. But even that small movement was enough to let Penn see the rage that was reflected in the flat, cold eyes. When he was 20 feet from the elf, he stopped. "Give up the boy. He belongs to us now.
You can keep the old man and the girl as compensation for your trouble. Take them and go.
Aaron Elicidal shook his head. I don't think I care to take you up on your offer. I think we will all stay together.
Terek Molt nodded. Then you will all come with me. Either way, it makes no difference.
Ultimatums are the last resort of desperate men.
Don't play games with me, outcast.
What has happened to you, Terek Molt, that you would betray the Ard Ris and the Order this way? You were a good man once.
The dwarf's face darkened. I am a better man than you, Aran Elicidal. I am no cat's paw, underling fool in league with a monster. I am no tool at the beck and call of a witch.
Are you not?
I'll say this once. I got tired of the Ard Ris, of her disruptive presence and her self-centered ways. I got tired of watching her fail time and again at the simplest of tasks. She was never right for the position. She should never have assumed it. Others are better suited to lead the Druid Council to the places it needs to go. Others who do not share her history.
A full council vote might have been a better way to go. At least that approach would have lent a semblance of respectability to your efforts and not painted all of you as betrayers and cowards. Perhaps enough others on the Druid Council might have agreed with you that all this would not have been necessary. The Elven Prince paused. Perhaps it still might be so, were someone of character to pursue it. He made it sound so reasonable, as if treachery could be undone and made right, as if the conversation was between two old friends who were discussing a thorny issue that each hoped to resolve. Is it too late to bring her back? He asked the other. The dwarf's face darkened.
Why bring her back when she is safely out of the way? What does it matter to you in any case? You have been gone from the council and her life for years. You are an outcast from your own people. Is that why you think so highly of her? Because she is like you?
I think better of Grianne Omsford than I do of Shadea Aru, the elf replied.
You can tell her so yourself once we are returned to Perenor.
Terek Molt came forward another step, black cloak billowing, one hand lifted and a gloved finger pointed.
Enough talk. I have chased you for as long as I care to. I am weary of the aggravation. You might have gotten away from me if those rovers hadn't stranded you in this swamp and then betrayed you to us.
Does that surprise you?
We caught up with them early yesterday, trying to slip past us in their pathetic little vessel. That captain was quick enough to tell us everything once he saw how things stood. So we knew where you were, and it was just a matter of waiting for you to show yourselves. Using magic was a mistake. It led us right to you.
Aran nodded. Unavoidable. What have you done with the Skaitlo and her crew?
The dwarf spit to one side. Rover vermin. I sent them on their way, back to where they came from. I had no need of them once they gave you up. They'll be halfway home by now and better off than those who so foolishly sought to use their services.
He looked past the other now to Penn.
I am done talking. Bring the boy. No more arguments. No further delays.
Aran Elicidal's hands had been tucked within his cloak. Now he brought them out again, balled into fists and bright with his magic's blue glow. Terek Molt stiffened, but did not give ground.
Do not be a fool, he said quietly.
I don't think Penn should go with you, Aran Elicidal said. I think you intend him harm, whether you admit to it or not. Druids are meant to protect, and protect him I shall. You have forgotten your teachings, Terek Molt. If you take one step nearer, I shall help you remember them. The dwarf shook his head slowly. His gloved hands flared with magic of his own.
You are no match for me, Elicidal. If you test me, you will be found wanting. You will be destroyed. Step aside. Give the boy to me and be done with this.
They faced each other across the short stretch of mud and shallow water, two identically cloaked forms born of the same order, but gone on separate paths. Elf and dwarf, faces hard as stone, eyes locked as if bound together by iron threads, poised in a manner that suggested there would be no backing down and no quarter given. Penn found himself tensed and ready as well, but he did not know what he would do when doing something became necessary. He could not think of anything that would help, any difference he could make. Yet he knew he would try. "Your ship," Arena Lissadil said suddenly to Terek Molt, and nodded in the direction of the Gallifile. The dwarf turned to look, did so without thinking, and in that instant Arren attacked, raising both hands and dispatching the elemental magic that he commanded in a burst of druid fire. But it was not the other man he targeted. It was the warship, his elemental magic striking the vessel with such force that it was rocked from bow to stern. The infuriated dwarf struck back instantly, his own fire hammering into the druid. Arren Elicidil had just enough time to throw up a shield before the other's magic knocked him completely off his feet and sent him sprawling in the mud. It was a terrible blow, yet Arren Elicidil was up again immediately, fighting off the warrior druid's second thrust, steadying his defenses. Now arrows and darts cast down by the gnome hunters who were gathered at the railing of the Gallifile began to rain on the beleaguered elf. Penn and Tagwin threw themselves out of the way as a few stray missiles nearly skewered them, then began crawling toward the protective shelter of the trees. Kyber screamed in rage, bringing up her own small druid-enhanced magic to protect herself, and crouched down close by Arren, poised to strike but still waiting on her uncle's command. Arren Elicidil was fighting for his life, down on his knees with his hands extended and his palms facing out, as if in a futile effort to ward off what was happening. His protective shield was eroding under the onslaught of Terek Molt's attack, melting like ice under searing heat. Yet once again he chose to strike not at the dwarf, but at the warship, diverting precious power from his defenses. Penn could not understand what the elf was thinking. Arren already knew that the ship was protected, that it was a waste of time and effort to try to damage her. Why was he persisting in this method of attack? Yet suddenly, improbably, the Gallifile began to shudder, massive hull and ram-shaped pontoons rocking as if caught in a storm instead of resting in shallow water. Something of what Arren was doing was making a difference after all. Terek Molt seemed to sense it as well and redoubled his efforts. Druid fire exploded out of his fingers and into the elf, staggering him, crumpling his shield. Penn heard Arren call out to Kyber, the signal for which she had been waiting, and immediately she had the elf stones in hand, arms outthrust. Brilliant blue light built about her fist, widening in a sphere that caused the boy to shield his eyes. Then the magic exploded from her clenched fingers in a massive rush that swept over the Gallifile like a tidal wave. For a single instant the druid warship was lit like a star, blazing with light, and then it burst into flames. It didn't catch fire in just one place or even a dozen. It caught fire everywhere at once, transformed into a giant torch. With a monstrous whoosh, it detonated in a fireball that rose hundreds of feet into the misty swamp sky, carrying with it the gnome hunters, bearing away a twisting, writhing Terek Molt as well, the latter sucked into the vortex. A roar erupted from the conflagration, burning with such fury that it scorched Penn and Tagwin 100 yards away, sweeping through the whole of the slags. In seconds, the Gallifile and all who had sailed her were gone. Penn looked up from where he lay flattened against the mud and scorched grasses. Smoke rising from his blackened form, Arren Elicidil lay sprawled on his back at the shoreline. Kyber knelt in shock some yards away, her arms lowered, the power of the elfstones gone dormant once more. Her head drooped as if she had taken a blow, and the boy could see her eyes blinking rapidly. She was shaking all over. He forced himself to his feet. Tagwin, he called over to the dwarf, finding him through eyes half blinded by smoke and ash. Tagwin looked up at him from where he was huddled in a muddied depression, his eyes wide and scared.
Get up. We have to help them.
The boy staggered across the flats, head lowered against the heat of the still fiery bay. Flames and ash-smeared waters were all that remained of the Gallifile. Penn glanced at the charred mix, baffled and awed by what had taken place, trying unsuccessfully to make sense of it. He reached Kyber and knelt beside her. He touched her shoulder.
Kyber,
he said softly. She did not look up or stop shaking, so he put his lips to her ear, whispering, Kyber, it's all right. It's over. Look at me. I need to know you can hear me. You're all right. So much power, she whispered suddenly. She stopped shaking then, her body going perfectly still. A long sigh escaped her lips. She lifted her head and looked out across the fiery surface of the wetlands. I couldn't stop it, Pen. Once it started, I couldn't stop it. I know, he said, understanding now something of what had transpired. It's all over. He helped her to her feet, and they stumbled together to where Tagwin knelt beside Aran Elicidal. Pen knew at a glance that the druid was dying. A handful of arrows and darts had pierced him, and his body was blackened and smoking from the explosion. But his eyes were open and calm, and he watched their approach with a steady gaze. Kyber gasped as she saw him, then dropped to her knees and began to cry, her hands clasped helplessly in her lap, her head shaking slowly from side to side. The druid reached out with one charred hand and touched her wrist. Tarek Molt tied his magic to the Gallifile, he whispered, his voice dry and cracked with pain. To protect her. When I attacked, he strengthened the connection until he was too committed to withdraw it. The Elfstones couldn't tell the difference. To them, the Gallifile was a weapon, an extension of Molt. So it consumed them both. I could have helped you. No, Kyber. He coughed, and blood flecked his burned lips. He couldn't be allowed to know that you had the Elfstones. Otherwise, he would have destroyed you. Instead, he destroyed you. She was crying so hard that she could barely make herself understood. The ruined face tilted slightly in response. I misjudged the extent of my invulnerability. Still, it is a reasonable trade. He swallowed thickly. The Elfstones are yours now. Use them with caution. Your command of their power. He trailed off, the words catching in his throat. You've seen the nature of your abilities. Strong. Your heart, mind, body. Very powerful. But the stones are more powerful still. Be wary. They will rule you if you are not careful. There is danger in using them. Remember. She lifted her tear-streaked face and looked over at Pen. We have to help him. She was almost hysterical. Pen was frightened, unable to think of what to say to her. There was nothing they could do. Surely she could see that. But she looked so wild that he was afraid she might try something anyway, something dangerous. Aran Elicidal's hand tightened on her wrist. No, Kyber, he said. He waited until she looked back at him, until she met his terrible, burned gaze. There is nothing to be done. It is finished for me. I'm sorry. His eyes shifted slowly to Pen. Penderin. 20 years ago, when I sailed on the Gerald Shannara with your father, a young girl gave up her life for me. She did so because she believed I was meant to do something important. I would like to think this is part of what she saved me for. Make something good come out of this. Do what you were sent here to do. Find the Ardreese and bring her back. He took several sharp, rattling breaths, his eyes holding the boy's as he struggled to speak. Aran? Pen whispered. Promise me. The druid's eyes became fixed and staring, and he quit breathing. Pen could not look away, finding in that terrible gaze strength of purpose he would not have believed possible. He reached out and touched the druid's charred face, then closed those dead eyes and sat back again. He looked over at Kyber, who was crying silently into her hands, then at Tagwin. I never thought anything like this would happen, the dwarf said quietly. I thought he would be the one to get us safely through. Pen nodded, looking out over the burning lake at the flames licking at the twilight darkness, staining sky and earth the color of blood. The surface of the water burned silently, steadily, a fiery mirror reflected against a backdrop of shadow-striped trees. Smoke mingled with mist and mist with clouds, and everything was hazy and surreal. The world had an alien feel to it, as if nothing the boy was seeing was familiar.
"What are we going to do?" Tagwin asked softly. He shook his head slowly, as if there were no answer to his question.
Penderyn Ohmsford looked over again at Kyber. She was no longer crying. Her head was lifted and her dark features were a mask of resolve. He could tell from the way she was looking back at him that there would be no more tears. The boy turned to the dwarf.
"We're going to do what he asked of us," he said. "We're going to go on."
Chapter 27 Shadea Aru stalked from the Druid Council without sparing even a glance back at those fools who expected it, her eyes directed straight ahead. She would not give them the satisfaction. She would give them nothing. She was seething with rage and frustration, but she would not let even a hint of it escape. Let them suspect what they wished about her true feelings. Their suspicions were the least of her problems. Her stride lengthening, she shouldered past the few grouped by the doors leading out, using her size and weight to brush them aside, and turned down the hallway toward the stairs leading up to her rooms. It was a kindness she bestowed on them, leaving so abruptly. Had she hesitated longer, she might have killed one of them. Surely that would have been more satisfying than anything else that had happened. She had spent the entire afternoon trying to convince the Council of the necessity of taking a stand on the war between the Federation and the Freeborn. She had insisted that no progress in the efforts of the Druid Order could be made until the war was concluded. It was inevitable, she argued, that the Federation, superior in men and materials, would emerge as the eventual victor. Better that it happen now, so that the rebuilding could begin, so that the work of the Druids could commence in earnest. Callahorn was Southland territory in any event, inhabited mostly by members of the race of man, and naturally aligned with the interests of the Federation. Let them have it. Make that the condition to ending the war. The Freeborn were a rebel outfit at best, consumed by the foolish insistence on keeping Callahorn for themselves. Remove the tacit support of the Druids, and the rebels would collapse. She did not tell the Council, of course, that she had made a bargain with Sen Dunsadan to help him secure control over the borderlands. She did not tell them that Federation control of Callahorn was the price of his support of her and her efforts to expand the authority and influence of the Order. That wasn't something they needed to know. It was enough that she was proposing a reasonable, common-sense solution to a problem that had plagued the Order since the day of its inception. But the Council had balked at adopting her proposal, its members led in their opposition by that snake, Garan Serra, who had insisted that a thorough study of the consequences of such drastic action was needed first. The matter was not as simple as the Ardreese was trying to make it seem, his argument went. Elven interests would be impacted by the outcome of the Federation Freeborn War in a significant way as well. Once he had mentioned the elves, it was only moments before the dwarves were insisting that their interests were important too. Soon everyone was arguing. Clever of him. Without repudiating the suggestion outright, he had managed to defer any action on it until a later date, all with an eye toward his own special interests, she was certain. Very well. He had won this day, but there would be another, although not necessarily for him. He was becoming something of a nuisance, one that she would have to deal with soon. If he could not be brought into line, he would have to be removed. For the moment, she had more pressing concerns. Sen Dunsadan would arrive in 3 days, and he would expect to hear that she had secured the Council's approval for Federation occupation of Callahorn, along with its open repudiation of freeborn claims to the land. He would be expecting a joint announcement of solidarity on the matter, one that would clearly indicate to the freeborn that their cause was lost. His expectations would not be met. She would have to tell him that the matter was not settled, that he would have to be patient. He would not like that, but he would have to live with it. He was used to disappointment. He would survive. She began to climb the stairs to the tower, conscious of the darkness pressing in from without, filtering through the windows to cast its shadows in the flickering torchlight. Nighttime already, and she had not yet eaten. She was halfway up when Treant Rowan appeared at the top of the stairs on his way down. She could tell at once that something was wrong. "You had better come, Shadea," he told her quietly, waiting until she had reached him, then turning back the way he had come. "The cold chamber." She fell in beside him, angry without yet knowing why. Has Molt failed yet again? Someone has. The scry waters indicate a massive collision of magics somewhere east of Anachere. The Gallifile is gone.
Gone?
She stared at him.
Gone where?
Destroyed. Obliterated. Her fists clenched in fury. How could Molt allow such a thing to happen? Her mind spun with possibilities. When was our last report from him?
Yesterday. Rowan wouldn't look at her. The message indicated he was in pursuit of the boy and the others, and had caught up with them in Anachere. That would have been 2 days ago.
She forced herself to stay calm, to think it through. Courier birds released from the Gallifile brought her regular messages from Molt, indicating where he was and what he was doing. Nothing in yesterday's message suggested the dwarf was in any trouble, let alone the sort that would cause a druid warship to be destroyed. Magic of such power was unusual, and it would have to have been employed in just the right way. The Elfstones? Perhaps. But Aran Elicidal was not a warrior druid or trained in battle the way Molt was. It was inconceivable that he would have prevailed in a confrontation. They entered the cold chamber to find Iridia Ileri standing at the basin, staring down at the scry waters with haunted eyes, arms folded across her rigid body. Her eyes snapped up at their entry, and the haunted look gave way to one of rage.
If you had sent me, this wouldn't have happened, she hissed at Shadea, making no effort to hide her feelings.
Shadea ignored her, walking over to the basin and looking down. Heavy ripples emanated from a point at the eastern shore of the Lazarene, perhaps somewhere within the slags. She knew that country. Dangerous to anyone, no matter how well armed or prepared. There was no mistaking what she was reading in the waters. The nature of the ripples clearly indicated a massive explosion, one instigated by a use of magic. The little blip that had served as a beacon for the Gallifile was gone. Treant Rowan was not mistaken in what he had told her. There's no way of knowing who survived this, she said, mostly to herself.
Not without sending someone to find out, Treant Rowan said. Iridia spun around the end of the basin and came face to face with Shadea. Although smaller of frame and stature, Iridia looked as if she intended to attack the bigger woman. Shadea took a step back in spite of herself.
This is on your head, Iridia snapped, her words as sharp-edged as daggers, her voice freezing the air. She was shaking with rage. You are responsible for this travesty. You and your insistence on doing whatever you choose to do. What do you need with the rest of us, Shadea? What have you ever needed with us? I thought you my friend once. I thought we were sisters. But you are incapable of friendship or loyalty or caring of any sort. You are as much a monster as that creature you summoned to bear the Steel. And I am no better. I have been one of your monsters, one of those who act in your behalf. I have been your tool.
She shook her head slowly.
No more. Not ever again.
She held the other's gaze for a moment longer, then turned and walked from the room. Unimpressed, Shadea watched her go. She thought it unfortunate that Iridia could no longer sort things out in a reasonable manner. Her attachment to Aran Elicidal had left her emotionally unstable, and Shadea found herself hoping that the Elven Prince had gone the way of the Gallifile. Then perhaps Iridia would come back to herself. Shadea looked over at Treant Rowan.
Are you of a like mind?
The druid shrugged. I am no one's tool, and I do what I choose. Iridia's problems are her own. On the other hand, I question the wisdom of your decision to send Taric Molt after that boy. I don't see the benefit to it. It distracts us from what matters.
What matters is making certain no one finds a way to bring the Arderis back, she snapped at him. Why can't you see that? All of you are so certain it can't be done. But remember who she is. Others thought her dead and gone as well, and lived to regret it.
No one can go into the forbidding.
Don't even speak the word.
She leaned close. It is bad enough that Aran Elisidal and the boy know what has happened, and it would be a mistake for us to think that they do not. They will seek a way to reach her. Successful or not, they will not forgive us for what we have done. This matter will not resolve itself while they live. If you think otherwise, say so now. He stared at her in silence, then shook his head. I think as you do. Shadea wasn't sure she believed him, but it was enough of an affirmation for now. She looked back at the scry waters. Another message would arrive by tomorrow if Tarek Molt was still alive. If not, then she could only hope that he had taken the boy, the elven prince, and that sycophant Tagwin with him to the grave. Then she could stop thinking about all of them and concentrate on what was happening at Perrinor. It occurred to her suddenly that she had forgotten about Aphasia Y, dispatched with the Steel, as Iridia had reminded her to eliminate the boy and his protectors. What of him? Even if the Gallifrey was destroyed, even if Tarek Molt was dead, perhaps the assassin was still carrying through on his task. Nothing would stop him once he set his mind to it. The only character flaw she had ever discovered was his troublesome streak of independence. On a whim, he might abandon the whole project. She stared down again at the scry waters, studying the diminishing series of ripples that marked the passing of the Gallifile. With Aphasia Y, she thought, you never knew. Iridia Ilari strode blindly from the cold chamber and down the hallway beyond, so furious she could barely make herself think. Tears leaked from the corners of her eyes, a series of ragged, glistening tracks on her perfect features. Had she stayed a moment longer, she would not have been able to hold them back. She stopped now, turning into a deep alcove in the empty hallway, and cried freely for several minutes, her body racked with sobs, her world collapsed about her. She knew what Shadea only suspected. Aran Elisidal was dead. The voice had told her so. When she stopped crying, she stood motionless in the alcove's darkness and forced herself to confront the truth. She had lied to herself.